from the studios of Kootenai Co-op Radio, this is Deconstructing Dinner.
And welcome to Deconstructing Dinner, a syndicated weekly one-hour radio show and podcast produced at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia. I'm John Steinman. Over the past week before this broadcast goes to air, Deconstructing Dinner has been on a whirlwind tour of Edmonton and Ottawa to attend the University of Alberta's International Week, with this year's theme being Hungry for Change, Transcending Feast, Famine, and Frenzy. And just a day before this broadcast was first recorded, I spoke to the Dairy Farmers of Canada at their annual policy conference held at the Chateau Laurier in Ottawa. And you can expect many recordings from those events in the coming weeks and months. But first, we visit day one of International Week at the University of Alberta, where keynote speaker Frances Moore-LaPay opened up the event with a moving talk that made it clear that since her 1971 release, Diet for a Small Planet, Frances's energy for ending hunger and increasing food security worldwide has not waned at all, and if anything, has only strengthened. Over the next hour, we'll listen in on Frances Moore-LaPay's entire keynote speech recorded on February 2nd, 2009 by Deconstructing Dinner. Frances is, of course, most well-known for her seminal book, Diet for a Small Planet, which shortly after led her to found the organization now known as Food First. In 2002, her and her daughter Anna founded the Small Planet Institute and co-wrote Hope's Edge, the next Diet for a Small Planet. Her latest book is Getting a Grip, Clarity, Creativity, and Courage in a World Gone Mad. Frances is the recipient of the Right Livelihood Award. Here's Frances Moore-LaPay at the University of Alberta's International Week in Edmonton.
I have to say that I feel that you all have created a new standard. I don't know if I can go back to an ordinary speaking event again after International Week. So I guess I'll just have to go around now and say, you've got to do it like they do it in Alberta. You really have created a magnificent program, and I am deeply honored to be the kickoff. And thank you, Nancy Hanneman. Thank you, Elise, and all of you, and the president, and all of you for coming to give me a chance to share with you what gets me up in the morning. What's been getting me up in the morning, actually, as you heard, for almost 40 years. I recently ran across the words of Dee Hock, who said, "It is far too late and things are far too bad for pessimism." And I kind of, that's the spirit that I try to get up in the morning. And I hope that that you share that sense. So as I was preparing this talk, I thought, well, maybe I should really rethink of the title of it as The Work of Hope. Because I've come to see over the decades that hope is work. You know, hope is not something we're sort of born with, like a disposition, and we get up, oh, I'm hopeful. Actually, no. It is something, and it's not even something we can seek in evidence. I've come to believe, and it's kind of become the motto of my daughter and my institute, that hope is not what we seek in evidence, it's only what we become in action. And it's not any kind of action. Because actually, some actions, what I think of as random acts of sanity, can actually end up making us feel futile if we can't see how it's connecting to underlying causal patterns. So I've come to feel that the work of hope means really one thing to me. It means peeling away the layers of causation until we can actually see a pattern and know that our actions are actually interrupting the downward spiral that's pulling us into more and more hunger and deprivation. Interrupt that and reverse it toward life. That's the work of hope. So that's where I am in my life. And putting it another way, just to throw out another sort of image, is you often hear from people, oh, I'm just a drop in the bucket. What do I matter? You know, my individual acts. Well, my daughter and I, when we were on our tour for our book, Hope's Edge, we were in Seattle one night. And we thought, wait a minute. Buckets actually fill up pretty fast on a rainy night in Seattle. So the problem isn't being a drop in the bucket. It's actually magnificent if you're helping to fill up something, right? The problem is most of us can't see the bucket. We can't see the vessel that our individual contributions are actually filling up. Because if we could, being a drop would be magnificent. So putting it another way then, we have to dig to understand what is the vessel, what is the container in, that makes our individual efforts count. And so over the years, I've struggled with that a lot and ask this question that you heard from Elise, the question, why is it, how can we understand that we as individuals are creating societies that we actually abhor? How do we make sense of that? That nobody would get up in the morning and say, yes, 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 I want there to be more hunger in the world, and yet that is what is happening. So gradually over the decades, I have learned from many great teachers and gradually have come to see something that now feels pretty obvious to me, and that is that we human beings are fundamentally creatures of the mind, that through the human eye, there is no unfiltered reality, that we actually create the world moment to moment according to the frames that we hold that tell us what is possible and what's not possible, and ultimately, what is human nature. I remember reading a book by the social philosopher Eric Fromm in his book, The Anatomy of Human Destructiveness, and he writes, "It is man's humanity that makes him so inhuman." What does that mean? And what he says, it's our distinct, this quality of human beings that we create what Anna and I call mental maps, what he calls frames of orientation through which we see. And that's all fine if our mental map is life-serving. But, and here's my message, that you and I are alive in this extraordinary moment in the story, in the human story, in which the dominant mental map that we absorb every day as an invisible ether is fundamentally life-destroying. This is the pivot point for our species. Can we break free? Can we break out of it or not? And that I've come to by looking at hunger. It seems to me that, you know, that's a good place to start. Here we are, this brainy species, and we haven't yet figured out what every other species has, you know, how to feed ourselves and our offspring. So here I go. I think this discovering, understanding what is this dominant mental map, and I'm not claiming that it is the only way to look at it, because I think it's up to each of us to go this deep, but I'll share with you where I am in this process. My sense is that we absorb a fundamentally flawed mental map that is malaligned both with our nature, human nature, and with the natural world. Its premise is lack. Its premise is scarcity. There's not enough goods, and there's not enough goodness. There's not enough of anything. There's not enough food, there's not enough energy, there's not enough parking places, there's not enough love, there's not enough anything. And there's not enough goodness in us, because if you peel away the layers, what human nature really is, all we can really count on, this is the message that we absorb, all we can really count on is that we are selfish, competitive, acquisitive, materialistic. That's all that we can really, really count on. So to understand hunger in the world today, we have to probe this deep. Because if we really start from the premise of lack of goods and goodness, then it follows like night to day that we believe that we must turn over our fate to some impersonal force because we ourselves are too flawed to come together in true democratic deliberation and negotiation over a common sense, common interest. So we feel we have to turn over our fate to some impersonal force, some magical force, ideally, at least what Ronald Reagan called the magic of the market. And we have to narrowly focus, since there's not enough of anything, we have to focus like a laser on producing more. So that is the dominant mental map that I am claiming today is actually making things worse year by year. So the scarcity frame, let me just start, that it lacks credibility, number one. It lacks credibility because, in fact, if you take the world food supply, if you look at the last few years, for example, last period, production of food has kept ahead of population growth. Just in the last couple of years, when we've been experiencing perhaps the most extreme rapid growth in the number of hungry people, production has kept well ahead of population growth. We've seen some record harvests. And yet today, 1 billion people are officially hungry, and over 100 million people have been pushed into the ranks of hunger just in the last 2 years, over 100 million. In other words, it's in numbers, we're talking about something twice as horrific as when I began this 40 years ago. So I want to make myself really, really clear as I begin that scarcity is not our problem. The world produces enough to make us all quite chubby, in fact. And that's just on the leftovers. Just on the leftovers. Think about it. About half of now what the world produces in food is either fed to livestock, which then shrink it in terms of its nutrients that we get, or it is now increasingly turned into agrofuel. Or think of now, you know, when I wrote Diet for a Small Planet, I was just so appalled and so struck that we were feeding then a third of our grain to livestock. Well, now we're feeding over a third of the fish catch, either to other fish or as feed for livestock. So I'm saying that even on the leftovers, there's enough. So clearly, scarcity is not our problem. And yet, if you read now the dominant messages coming out of the international agencies, the G8 meetings, etc., still the emphasis is on, we just have to, I was just reading on the plane here the latest UN support on food insecurity, and on page 4 it says, the problem is a lack of concerted effort to combat hunger. We just have to try harder. And a great deal of emphasis now on the distribution of more seeds to low-income countries throughout the world, the premise being not enough. So we are, as I say, at a choice point. What would it mean, really, to examine the roots, to go to challenge this premise of lack of goods and goodness? What would it mean? But before I do that, let me just go a little bit deeper into the frame that I am working from. I've said that the false frame is the lack of goods and goodness that then has us focus on more, 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 even as hunger worsens, production goes up, hunger worsens, more food, more hunger. So what I'm suggesting that the fundamental shift has to be from a premise of lack to a premise of possibility, a premise that indeed human beings are complex enough, we're multidimensional enough, so there is plenty of goodness in us. And I focus on particularly 4 hardwired qualities that we can count on, and I'll get into those in a minute. And that certainly the natural world, ecology, as we align with it, there is plenty for all of us. What would it mean to shift then from a focus on things and a supply of scarce things to a focus on alignment of human relationships, alignment of human relationships with what we know now, the complexity of human nature, and what we know now about how ecology works? We have so much more knowledge now than we have ever had, of course, as human beings have tried to survive well on this planet. So what would it mean? It would mean that we get very realistic. Now, some of you might think that my frame is soft-headed. Actually, I think it's very hard-nosed. I call it heart-centered realism, because it says that we humans have the capacity, yes, we have to acknowledge, not just a few of us, but most of us, and we don't know whether we're one of them or not, in the wrong conditions, will brutalize and will actually be extraordinarily cruel to one another. Now, this is important. This is an important point. It may sound like I've drifted. I haven't. If any of you are aware of the lab studies done on us, as if we needed lab studies when you look at the history of the Holocaust or Abu Ghraib, but even if you look at the lab studies where we're the guinea pigs, such as the infamous one at Stanford University the same year that my book Diet for a Small Planet came out, where the psychology professors, Philip Zimbardo, put young people in a mock prison, supposed to last for 2 weeks. These young people had tested normal psychologically. They were put into a mock prison situation where power was extremely unequally divided. So there were the prison guards and there were the prisoners. Within 6 days or fewer, I believe. Yeah, it was 6 days. Dr. Zimbardo had to stop the experiment because these young people were brutalizing one another in ways eerily similar to Abu Ghraib. And actually, he testified in the hearings about those who were arrested for the treatment of prisoners in Abu Ghraib. My point only is that under the wrong conditions, and one of them certainly that now we can pinpoint is the concentration of power, human beings will do very bad things to one another. That is certain. So I'm saying that we know that about human beings, and we also know, and again we can rely on this wonderful new science coming out, that we are also hardwired for profoundly pro-social capacities that enable us to get to the roots of hunger and create communities in which we can all eat. And what I mean by those, I'll just select four here in the interest of time. One is we are hardwired to cooperate. We are hardwired to cooperate. You know that when they've looked at our brains in MRI scans while we're competing and cooperating, they've actually found that when people cooperate, the parts of our brains are stimulated that are the same as when we eat chocolate. Yes, cooperating is as pleasurable as eating chocolate. So empathy, yes, empathy is hardwired in us also. I like to think that we are at least as empathetic as the rhesus monkey who, bless their hearts, will refuse to eat for up to 12 days if some mean experimenter has set it up so that these monkeys have to press a bar that would send a shock to another monkey in order to eat themselves. They will forego food to protect their buddy monkeys. So empathy, and I could go on about that too, but let me just jump to another thing that I believe is hardwired, and that is a deep need for fairness. Adam Smith, you remember that name, some of you studying economics and philosophy? He is often considered the godfather of greed. In fact, I understand that during the Reagan years that they were actually wearing Adam Smith neckties in the White House. But Adam Smith was a profound moral philosopher who said very pointedly and poignantly that we understand, we human beings, his observations. This is before the days of neuroscience studies, but his observation was that we understand that our own preservation depends on the preservation of community, and we understand that injustice is what breaks community down. Our own survival, then, we know that we have to have fairness in order for communities to work. And so he said, let's see if I can pull up the quote. He says, other social sentiments may be optional, but he wrote, we are, quote, in some peculiar manner tied, bound, and obliged to the observation of justice. And again, the animal studies, I don't know if you saw this recently, but I was so amused and tickled because, of course, it confirmed what I'm saying. Dogs will be just delighted to do these, games of shaking the hands of their, paw handshake with the experimenters just for the fun of the reaction of the experimenter, right? No reward until they see another dog getting a goodie for doing the same thing. And then they go on strike and say, no way. And the same with the Capuchin monkeys. They found that in these studies that, the monkeys would get their rations and accept them, except when some other monkeys were getting better rations, getting grapes and I'm a monkey. These are capuchin monkeys. I'm only getting a cucumber. And they started throwing them back. So I like to think that this is some, I mean, it's intuitively, it makes sense to me what Adam Smith is saying, that fairness is the basis of community. Without it, it dissolves, and we know that we depend on community. So I'm just saying then that I'm making the point that we know we have these profound pro-social needs and capacities. We also, virtually all of us, under the wrong conditions of especially extreme concentration of power and the othering, as you know, the prisoner versus guard, they wore their garb, so it's people are depersonalized and can bring out absolutely horrific behavior in most of us. So we can be both. So it seems to me, let's step up as a species and say, what are the rules? What are the conditions that bring out the best in us and keep in check the worst in us? And I think that the answers to that are pretty clear. And I just want to add, when we squelch, when we deny these positive qualities in us, they don't just shrink and die. We get clinically depressed. Did you know that depression is the fourth leading cause of loss of productive life in the world, and it's shooting up to be number two within a decade or so? So we don't do well in societies that violate these very, very deep social capacities of ours.
And this is Deconstructing Dinner, a syndicated weekly one-hour radio show and podcast produced at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia. You're listening to author Francis Moore LePay speaking in February 2009 at the University of Alberta in Edmonton. Francis was invited to deliver a keynote address to open the university's International Week titled Hungry for Change, Transcending Feast, Famine, and Frenzy. More recordings from the event will air on Deconstructing Dinner over the next few weeks and months. And if you miss any of today's broadcast, it is archived on our website at deconstructingdinner.ca under the February 5th, 2009 episode.
So here we are. That's my challenge. But before I continue on that theme, I want to bring us right back to hunger and development and describe then how our mental map is undermining. And then I'm going to end with stories of possibility where we are accepting the good and the bad of our nature and creating the rules and norms that bring out the best in us and keep the worst in check. So how did we get here in a world in which now almost a billion are hungry and yet there's more than enough for us all? Well, from this turning over, this is where I was a few minutes ago, this sense of lack of goods and goodness, we turn over our fate to not any kind of market. And this is the interesting piece for me, because markets have always been part of human social history, or at least not always, but for a very long time. But somehow we hit on this idea that a market could work, and this is the ether that we breathe, a market could work if it's run essentially by a single rule, highest return to existing wealth, the CEOs and the stockholders. It's a, you know, on the surface, it's kind of a funny idea. I mean, you'd think that we would have seen through this, we would have seen this as a problem after having played Monopoly a few times. And I remember, you know, in growing up, and actually I was kind of relieved when my brother got all the property because I could go to bed. But that's okay in a game. It's not okay in life, because the equivalent would be I die, or I become homeless, and I'm out of the game. So the interesting little piece here, I learned a few years ago that the inventor of Monopoly was a Quaker woman in the early 20th century that wanted it to be an object lesson in what would happen if this one rule economics, just highest return to people already have the cash. Well, Lizzie's idea got into the hands of Parker Brothers, and actually, it became an object lesson, because now five corporations in the United States control most board games. But we didn't get the deeper lesson of what happens in a one-rule economy. And so in this one-rule economy, then, what has happened is that we buy into the notion, certainly from the 1980s onward, the message going out, in fact, the condition set on much of global aid and trade rules had to do with, oh, you poor countries, you're going to do much better if you reduce public, any kind of public support for agriculture, and you open your doors to unfettered imports. Great. That's the direction that you should go. And then, of course, we in the global north didn't follow the same advice. In the U.S., we massive subsidies for our farmers, and then we have trade deals with this highly unequal system so that, for example, in Mexico, you may already know this, but it's extraordinary. After the free trade agreement, the North American Free Trade Agreement, within a few years, almost 2 million corn farmers had been put out of business by cheap exports from the United States. Mexico had bought the idea. Oh, yes, you know, we reduce our supports for agriculture, open our doors. U.S. corn, subsidized corn, wiped out the basic farm economy there. And so what we see from there, from the Philippines to Haiti and elsewhere, countries that were food, that were largely food self-sufficient. You think of the Philippines, for example, that was a major rice producer, is now the leading importer of rice and extremely, therefore, dependent. So what happens then? What happens when we accept this notion of a lack, that we don't have it in us to come together and really create a market that operates within a democratic polity that sets rules, because a market is a very, very handy device if it is set up so that wealth continues to circulate and competition is protected. But if we accept it from this mental map of lack and turn over our fate to a one-rule economy, it ends up actually killing the very virtues that supposedly it was serving to begin with, efficiency, and competitiveness. I mean, what could be less efficient than a world food economy in which we are shrinking supply by feeding ever greater quantities to livestock and now creating agrofuel from the land? What could be less competitive than a world in which fewer and fewer corporations now control throughout our food system, from the trading and processing to the retail level, fewer and fewer corporations in control. For example, just 6 corporations now control most of the world's grain trade. And seeds, I find this particularly poignant. In 30 years ago, there were hundreds of seed companies. Today, one company, Monsanto, controls about a fifth of the commercial seed market. And in genetically modified seeds, it's over 90%. So, of course, it gets worse and worse here, because once economic power is that tightly concentrated, it then begins to infect and distort our political systems. And so in the United States, over 10 years, these large agribusiness companies have contributed $1 billion in lobbying money spent to influence the decision-making in our democracy. And so we reach the point, what a friend of mine has recently called privately held government. And I think that's an interesting term. But it brings me to the words, and we've been warned about the consequences of what happens when we allow this mystified market then outside of democratic accountability to so concentrate its power that it then distorts political decision-making. We've been warned by many. But no one more eloquently, perhaps, than Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who in April of 1938, he was addressing a joint session of Congress. And he put it this way. He said, "The liberty of democracy is not safe. If a people tolerate the growth of private power to the point that it is stronger than the democratic state itself, that, in its essence, is fascism." This is an American president. Now, I have to admit, I have not found the courage to use the F word without quoting an American president. But I'm working on that courage, because I think it's so shocking that he named it private power so concentrated that it overwhelms the public voice. So we then are blinded by this mental map so that we cannot see that today's chronic hunger, even before this latest crisis that has pushed 110 million more people into hunger, that even before that, that hunger is inevitably flows from this concentration of power that we've already figured out brings out the worst in us. And so that then we were absolutely set up for the last 2 years of this intense, we went from chronic to acute. And so what happened, in part what happened, and in a short talk, I can't go into all of the different elements here, but in part what happened is that in the U.S., which is the epicenter, of course, of the current global financial crisis, over 2 decades, we pulled back on democratic accountability, on safeguards in our financial institutions. And now we know, if we look at this complex human nature, of course, if the rules pulled back and allowed unprincipled behavior, then that subprime debacle was just virtually inevitable, that people would take advantage, the operators who wanted to, and create, as you've heard, financial instruments that are so complex and mysterious, non-transparent, that even Warren Buffett said he didn't really understand them. That's when I got really worried. And so then what happens, as that began to wobble in 2007, is that the subprime thing became the looming threat. Then investors, speculators ran from real estate, and where did they go? They went to commodities that seemed like a surer bet. And so what happens then is this spike in food prices having very little to do with the actual supply, as I've argued. The food production has been continued to go up. And so what happens then is who benefits? In 2007, Archer Daniels Midland made it a 65% increase in its profits. The really interesting part to me is that the biggest part of that was from its financial division, which has nothing to do necessarily with its actual movement of trading of commodities, but rather the speculative game it was also playing through its financial division on the volatility of food prices. So here we are. Here we are. So what I'm suggesting then is that these elevated prices, which are now expected to continue, even though as even though the crisis level is over, but expected to continue. Now then, let me just say, at this very same moment, what I find stunning is that throughout the world, on every continent, and what changed my life so dramatically was being able to travel the world with my daughter in the year 2000 and actually see and smell and taste the emergence of living democracy, of people stepping up, whether it be in India or Bangladesh or Kenya or Brazil, people stepping up and saying, oh yes, the market is a very useful tool. But not that they would use these words, this is my understanding of what they are doing in action, but yes, it is. If it is embedded in actual balanced human relationships where power is not concentrated, but it is shared and negotiated and there's mutual accountability, that is the difference. It's a shift from, oh, we can develop just if we focus on producing more, and it was a sense, oh, we can develop if we come together and use our common sense and build power together and keep it circulating. And so that really is what I've come to see as an ecology of democracy that I've been able to witness. And let me just give you now a few tastes of what this looks like. I want to start with the fact that, we hear in the business pages, all we see is the news on the stock markets and shareholders, and yet cooperatives, which are not on the business pages typically, have doubled in membership in the last 30 years, and that there are actually more people who are members of cooperatives than there are people who own shares in publicly traded companies in the world. And these cooperatives are supplying more jobs in the world than our multinational corporations. Again, largely invisible, but this is part, I think, of rethinking economics as that which can be structured in a way to prevent what we know will bring out the worst in us, the concentration of power, and particularly economic power. So I think of India, for example, when, you know, I turn on the radio and I hear about the Indian miracle and I hear about the call centers, I experience the call centers and the high-tech jobs, and what we don't hear about is actually more jobs have been created by villagers working together and improving their incomes than in these high-tech industries. For example, starting about 30 years ago, a network of village women created a dairy cooperative that that involves a network of 100,000 village-level dairies and nearly 11 million members that has helped to make India one of the world's leading producers of dairy. And this model, because we are social mimics and we take our cues from one another, that this then caught on in Bangladesh, where something called the Milk Vita Cooperative in Bangladesh has replicated this success, enabling 300,000 households to increase their earnings tenfold.
And this is Deconstructing Dinner. You're listening to author Francis Moore LePay speaking in February 2009 at the University of Alberta in Edmonton. Francis is the author of Diet for a Small Planet, Hope's Edge, and Democracy's Edge, among others. She traveled from Boston, Massachusetts to deliver a keynote address to open the university's International Week titled Hungry for Change, Transcending Feast, Famine, and Frenzy. And if you enjoy the content of today's episode and other episodes of this show, we would benefit from your financial support for this project, which we offer free of charge to radio stations across the country. You can help support this program by visiting deconstructingdinner.ca and selecting Donate, or you can call 352-9600, area code 250, and learn how you can send a check or money order to support our ongoing efforts to inform you and others about the impacts our food choices have on ourselves, our communities, and the planet. And here again is Francis Moore LePay.
Staying in India for a minute, I have followed somewhat over the last 20 years the evolution of the southern state of Kerala, with a population not too much, just kind of comparable to Canada. And 14 years ago, the southern state of Kerala began what they called a people's campaign for decentralized planning, in which citizens, according to one report, quote, gained unprecedented authority in bringing their ideas forward, particularly women. One in four households in Kerala participated in village assemblies during the first 2 years of this, and a lot of participation has continued in projects that include housing, small-scale irrigation, agricultural projects that were particularly beneficial to women and untouchables. Now, Kerala is important to follow because it's more inclusive practices over decades has meant that even though per capita income is about 5% of the U.S., its people, through these sorts of processes, have achieved a level of literacy and health statistics that are comparable with the industrial countries. And most people have never heard of the India state of Kerala. I mentioned the cooperative movement just a moment ago. And it's one aspect of democratizing economic life. Another feature that I've been learning from is the democratization of finance. How many of you have heard of microcredit? Many of us have heard of this idea of making credit available to poor villagers throughout the world who now are dependent largely on moneylenders who require exorbitant rates of interest for small loans. But I sense that even there, that we don't fully grasp often the potential of what this really represents. And that is that I think microcredit, much of it that I have observed and I'm trying to learn more about, is not just the miniaturization of capitalism, if you will, just, you know, making smaller loans but still keeping power concentrated in a bank and the shareholders, but rather a whole different way of thinking about finance. Grameen Bank, which my daughter and I visited in the year 2000, Grameen Bank is not just a bank. It is also a social movement, and the owners are actually the village women who are also the people whose money is lended and who receive the loans. They are the owners. And when I say social movement, I mean that it would be as if you went into your local bank and said, yes, you can get a loan here if you will join with your neighbors and work with your neighbors and be willing to commit to keeping your children in school and growing a community garden. And this is a kind of integrated notion of finance that I think many of us would find it kind of hard to imagine. It's banking as part of a social movement. And more recently, in the last 10 years, what has begun to happen is something, and I think that the term microcredit is probably should be replaced more accurately to call it social lending. And maybe that's not the greatest term either, but the idea that it's a very different, it's not just breaking down the numbers into smaller pieces, loans into smaller pieces, but it's rethinking lending as a social activity. And for example, I read about and met someone who had been founder of, initiator, I should say, of a social lending network of women in Nepal. And he describes it as there is no bank such as the Grameen Bank, you know, in Dhaka, where you can see the money ends up and then it's more structured. But rather, it in Nepal, and now this model is spreading throughout the world, it was just village women coming together in a circle and agreeing on the rules and committing themselves to supporting one another. And he said, when I interviewed him about this, he said, 56,000 women started businesses and generated $3 million in new revenues during the first 18 months. And then his eyes twinkled. He said, and that was before we got our curricula to them of how to do it. Just planting the idea. And it's just and teaching one another to read and write and do basic accounts again, without trained teachers coming into the villages, but women coming to believe that they had this in themselves and were just astonishingly successful. Again, being replicated now in Africa. So, I'm saying that looking from another lens, this lens of democracy as a living process in which we understand what brings out the best in us, these social networks that keep wealth circulating and keep power dispersed and constantly newly generated. I think of also another example from India, and then I'm going to go to Brazil for my last story, but I've been reading about the state in India, Andhra Pradesh, which I had read earlier as just a horror story of pesticide use and health issues related to over-pesticide use and therefore suicides, because farmers took out loans to get their production going, often with Monsanto seeds, so they were dependent on the foreign corporation to supply the seeds for their farms, growing cotton using a lot of pesticides. And I saw it as just a horror story. Then, in the last year or so, another story is coming out of this region. Farmers themselves becoming so aware and so alarmed by the spate of suicides, farmers drinking pesticides to kill themselves because they couldn't repay the loans for these purchased inputs. Animals getting sick, people getting sick because of pesticide exposure. And they started saying no to that path. And now, in 16 out of the 23 districts in Andhra Pradesh, there are villages that are embracing, about 1 million acres, embracing what they call non-pesticide management. It's not completely organic, but it's headed that way, and very much with a consciousness that what makes sense for us is to build on through traditional techniques of agriculture to diversify our fields so that we can have some food to eat, so that we're not dependent simply on purchased foods, and that we can use the traditional pest controls, including the neem tree, which is an ancient tree that's extract has been used for millennia in as a pest control substance. And so this reliance then, moving away from chemicals, relying not on purchased seeds but on the sharing of seeds, means that their cost of production have gone down so much that even though their yields haven't increased and maybe a little bit less, but comparable to what they were doing before, their profits has increased on average 18% in many of the villages that were summarized in the study that I was looking at. And people's medical bills have gone down because they're not experienced the pesticide exposure. And they're, of course, more food secure because of the variety of crops that they're growing. So it is an example of villagers coming to they call it community management, villagers coming together, learning from one another, and sharing transparent information. I saw a picture of a large sign in the middle of the village that had the returns on average from those who were still using the pesticide approach, still using the purchased inputs, the Monsanto seeds, and those who were using the traded, the shared seeds and a non-pesticide approach, and seeing who profited in the end. And because the non-pesticide approach had fewer overhead costs and less medical costs, at the end they were doing much better. So I just want to share one more story with you before I wrap up, and that comes from Brazil. I was in Brazil to, and this I think could happen anywhere. It could happen in Edmonton. It could happen in Boston, where I live. The residents of Belo Horizonte, the fourth largest city in Brazil, they elected in 1993 a government, that an administration that said, we are standing on the platform of food as a human right. Food is a right of citizenship. And we're saying to our citizens, if you elect us, we're saying to you that, yes, if you're too poor to buy food in the marketplace, we're still accountable to you. And therefore, we will work to make good food, not just any food, good food available to everyone in the city. They were elected, and in a leadership role was a woman named Adriana Aranha, who's become a great hero of mine. And she was the facilitator of a city agency that came up with working with citizens group, came up with dozens of innovations, such as small plots of city-owned land that were made available to small farmers, organic farmers. And because there was no middleman taking the big cut, the small farmer was able to thrive, and we talked to several of them, to really thrive while keeping food within the reach of the poorest in the inner city in Belo. They took the amount of money that was provided by the federal government in Brazil, and instead of buying corporate processed food with it, they bought local organic food with it, and the nutrient value of children's meals shot up. Shifting the frame, they began to see things that had been thrown out. They began to see them as possible sources of nutrition, so that manioc leaves and eggshells were ground into powder and put into children's biscuits in nursery schools throughout the city. And in 10 years, on less than 2% of the city budget, Belo Horizonte reduced infant death by half, more than half. And when I talked to Adriana at the end of our visit there, I said, do you realize that you're completely out of step? You're really saying that government and citizens can be partners, and that government is not just about handouts, but actually about facilitating and fair rule setting, accountable to citizens? You're really out of step with the global trend toward saying the government can do no good and the market can do no harm. So Adriana, in answering my question, just went on and on in Portuguese, and I don't understand a word of Portuguese. And I tried to be really patient until her eyes began to tear up. And at that point, I couldn't be patient anymore. And I interrupted and said, please, would the translator tell me what's making Adriana cry? And what she said was, yes, I knew how out of step we were. I knew how much hunger there is in the world. But what I didn't know, and what upsets me so, is how easy it is to end it. And what Adriana is saying to us, and I hope is captured in this talk, is that if we are willing to do what she did, step outside the dominant frame, rethink, and to walk with our fear of being different, then it does become easy. We see with new eyes. And that really is the challenge of this moment. That it really is the challenge. So it gets then to be very personal. How do we take this idea into our daily lives here in Edmond? How do we do it? And because any of these stories could be translated right back into your community, how are finances rethought of as part of a democratic community in based on social relationships, not that which power is widely dispersed, not just ruled by some automatic magical force, but really something that is thought through together. How can cooperatives thrive here as democratic institutions? These are questions. How could Edmonton, you know, do something like Belo Horizonte did? Again, bringing all sorts of citizen innovations forward and then having that kind of dramatic effect. Well, I sort of think of to be an Adriana Arana, if I can boil it down to that, for me requires what I call bold humility. And bold humility begins with rethinking fear. That's the bold part. The bold part is rethinking fear, not as something... Well, let me say that part of our evolution, I think, is that we evolved in these closely knit tribes in which we knew a couple of things about fear. The fear sensations in our bodies, in my case, it's the pounding heart and the agitation, that we trusted those. We trusted those. And, you know, that meant we had to flee or fight or freeze, right? And we also knew that separating from the tribe was pretty certain death. That's what we learned about fear. Okay, now, here we are, the early 21st century, and the entire hyper tribe is heading over Victoria Falls. So it seems to me, in this extraordinary moment that you and I are alive, that fear takes on a whole different meaning. Because to separate from the tribe, to separate from the pack, if you will, may mean life, not death. And that fear, then, doesn't necessarily mean we're in the wrong place, wrong time, doing the wrong thing. It might just mean that we are doing exactly what we need to be doing to promote life itself, ours and others. So we have to rethink fear simply as information, not as a verdict, simply as information, in order to be able to move. Not to get over fear, because I think that is absolutely impossible. It's hardwired. But to be able to walk with it. To be able to walk with it. So I have a little trick. Well, I'll share with you. It's a little corny. My daughter calls it cheesy, but there it is. And that is that this pounding heart of mine, I know that I feel it most when I'm about to say something I think is controversial or difficult for somebody to hear. And so I've started renaming it Inner Applause. And when I hear that inner applause, I think, oh, good, you've got to go for that. And it completely, well, not completely, but it somewhat, it makes me much more able to keep going. So the bold part, but the humility part is equally important. And as I get old, I realize that the humility is much easier as I age because I realize, like when I was traveling with my daughter, talk about humbling, I realize that all the things that we were experiencing, whether it's Wangari Maathai, who planted 7 trees on Earth Day in 1977, having no idea of what could come from it. And ultimately, for her environmental activism, was beaten and jailed. And then when we left her in the year 2000, when we were leaving Kenya, it was still under a dictatorship. And we didn't know if the Greenbelt Movement could survive. They had at that point planted 20 million trees. And we didn't know if it could survive. Would we know that just a few years later, 2004, she'd get that call from the Nobel Peace Prize Committee saying that she'd won the Nobel Peace Prize for her actions. And now 40 million trees planted from those 7. Would I have ever predicted that? Probably not. So the humility part is recognizing that the things that most inspire me today, I would have probably given about that much chance of success when I was my children's age and beginning this work. And so the humility piece is simply recognizing that it is not possible to know what's possible. It is not possible to know what's possible. And if we really accept that, then we are absolutely free to follow our curiosity, follow our heart, follow our energy, and our where those who we look up to find the people who are just a little bit more bold than we are and associate with them, because we know we're probably become that way ourselves, given the fact that there are these mirror neurons in our brains now that we where we are constantly experiencing what we observe. So this theme of it's not possible to know what's possible, this theme that, in fact, the world is moving in two dramatically different directions. One is greatly worsening the experience of needless hunger throughout the world and worsening the climate crisis at the same time. And at the same time, the stories I've mentioned from Belo Horizonte or Andhra Pradesh or Nepal or India, that these are equally as real, but they are still invisible. But we can help make them visible. So that really is the theme then. And as I think of this idea that we are moving in two directions at once, I realize that what is called for as we begin to think of this bold humility, at least it works for me, this idea of rethinking fear and humility, that we then grow our hearts big enough to hold both the pain and the possibility, that we learn to hold it all somehow. I think of as the expanding heart, the being able to sing and weep at the same time. And that will then allow us to just open our eyes to accept all aspects of the human, complex human being, and recognize that we can now see what brings out the best in us and what and how we can keep the worst of us in check through what I call living democracy, aligned with this more realistic sense of human nature and aligned with ecology itself. And so I would like to end with a poem that means a great deal to me, that captures everything I've been trying to say, but much more simply and briefly. It is a poem about hope by Denise Levertov. We have only begun to love the earth. We have only begun to imagine the fullness of life. How can we tire of hope so much as in bud? How can desire fail? We have only begun to imagine justice and mercy. We have only begun to envision how it might be to live as siblings with beast and flower, no longer as oppressor. We've only begun to know the power that is ours if we would join our solitudes in a communion of struggle. So much is unfolding that must complete its gesture. So much is in bud. Thank you.
And that was Frances Moore LePay speaking in February 2009 at the University of Alberta in Edmonton. Frances is the author of Diet for a Small Planet, Hope's Edge, and her most recent, Getting a Grip, Clarity, Creativity, and Courage in a World Gone Mad. If you missed any of her keynote address, you can visit the show online at deconstructingdinner.ca, where this episode is archived under the February 5th, 2009 broadcast. And that was this week's edition of Deconstructing Dinner, produced and recorded at Nelson, British Columbia's Kootenai Co-op Radio. I've been your host, John Steinman. I thank my technical assistant, John Ryan. The theme music for Deconstructing Dinner is courtesy of Nelson area resident Adam Shake. This radio program is provided free of charge to campus community radio stations across the country and relies on the financial support from you, the listener. Support for the program can be donated through our website at deconstructingdinner.ca or by dialing 250-352-9600.